got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I got a broken thing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English. Today I'm chatting with Dr. Henry Miller, who asked that I just call him Henry. So Henry is a physician and a biologist at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. And for 15 years, he was with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, where he did some important work bringing the first genetically engineered insulin to the market. So I definitely want to talk to him about that. But on top of all his academic and regulatory work, Henry has written hundreds of editorials at this point about topics from the controversial herbicide glyphosate to GMO labeling to how federal regulations impact technology in farming and medicine. So since all of those topics really have been in the news recently, I just want to pick his brain and find out what's going on. So thanks so much for listening. Stick around. All right, Henry, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm good. It's a pleasure to be with you, Cameron.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of your work and I'm excited to chat. But for anybody who's not familiar with you, just give us an introduction and then tell us why you're so passionate about this issue of using biotechnology in agriculture and medicine.
Well, I've been a scientist for a long time, not a bench scientist for a while. I'm a physician and molecular biologist by training. After medical school, I did a year of internship, a year of residency, then was at NIH for 3 years as a postdoc, and then was recruited by FDA to be their biotechnology czar. And I was the reviewer for the early biopharmaceuticals, then became special assistant to the FDA commissioner, the agency head, and was the founding director of the Office of Biotechnology when it was formed, which was a policy office within the Office of the Commissioner. And since then, I've been at think tanks for 25 years. As a former regulator who took his job very seriously, getting products evaluated scientifically, getting them out in a timely way, I resent the job that current regulators have done. Bad policies, poorly implemented, extremely risk averse toward new products. And so that was reflected in my writing.
So I want to get more information about your time at the FDA, but going back just a little before the important work you did with insulin, can you tell me about the climate in the 1970s when recombinant DNA technology was really first being developed? How did the scientific community feel about it? And then how did the public think about it as much as they knew about it, using today as a backdrop, because it's still very controversial?
Well, it was largely unknown to the public at large. It would occasionally be reported in kind of apocalyptic terms, but it was the New York Times that first coined the term Frankenfoods, for example, back in the, I guess, the late 70s, early 80s. And the scientific community was sort of divided as to how it should be regulated. And there was the fateful Asilomar conference. Well, first, there was a voluntary moratorium on recombinant DNA research in the 70s for a while, largely at the urging of Paul Berg, Stanford biochemist, and some of his colleagues, because of concerns about introducing DNA from oncogenic viruses into bacteria, for example, the bacteria that could colonize the gut and cause problems and so on. But they were quite speculative concerns. And the voluntary moratorium was finally ended after the fateful Asilomar conference, so named because it was held at Asilomar, California. And proposals were made there for guidelines which would be promulgated by the NIH. And that indeed came to pass, and that ended the moratorium. But those guidelines were what I sometimes refer to as biotechnology regulations, original sin, because it introduced into regulation the concept of regulating process, regulating by technique, instead of regulating on the basis of the characteristics of a product, particularly the risk-related characteristics of a product. And we've been plagued by that sort of process-based regulation ever since at a spectrum of regulatory agencies in the U.S. and elsewhere.
So did that attitude carry over to the FDA? Because I remember reading a piece of yours, I think in the Wall Street Journal, where you said the first recombinant insulin that was developed, you and your team at the FDA were ready to approve it within about 4 months, but your boss wanted to put a hold on it. And so it was this mindset that you're talking about, this risk aversion, was that already in place when you were at the agency?
Well, yes, but you know, what you're talking about is implementation. What I was talking about a moment ago was policy formulation. And so at USDA, for example, instead of regulating according to the characteristics of an organism, which USDA had long done under the Plant Pest Act, which had inclusive lists of plant pathogens. And so if an investigator wanted to do experiments, field trials with an organism, there was a binary decision to be made on the basis of the pathogenicity of the organism. If it's a plant pathogen, you needed a permit from regulators. If not, you could do it without case-by-case review. FDA had a slightly different situation because pharmaceuticals were already subject to a significant degree of case-by-case review and regulatory oversight. And so FDA's decision, which was made while I was there, was that FDA would not treat recombinant DNA-derived products any differently from others, but again, subject to the normal, quote-unquote, the normal high level of scrutiny. What the incident that you're referring to, where we were evaluating the first biopharmaceutical, human insulin, brand name Humulin, produced in E. coli bacteria and grown in large fermenters. We received the application in May of 1982, and my small team worked assiduously on it. We're ready to approve it in 4 months. And this was at a time when the average time for approval of a new drug application was 30 and a half months. I took the completed dossier to my supervisor, and he said, in effect, 4 months, are you crazy? If anything goes wrong with this product down the road, people will say we rushed it. And so I had to wait until he went on vacation. I went to his boss, the division director, and he signed off on it. So it was a 5-month approval. But that illustrates the risk aversion that characterizes regulators. They're much more concerned, fearful about accidentally, inadvertently approving a product that has a problem or appears to have a problem than they are about delays, unnecessary delays in getting products out onto the market.
That's very brave of you to go up against your boss like that. Would you say things have gotten better or worse since your time there? And I have in mind that the two recent examples of the FDA on animal gene editing, and then of course the genetically engineered salmon that's finally going to come to the market. But my perception as an outsider, as a consumer, is that things really aren't that much better. What's your opinion on that?
Well, FDA has made some horrendous mistakes. They've done a pretty good job on biopharmaceutical, conventional biopharmaceuticals, vaccines, and especially on products that are derived from monoclonal antibodies or that are monoclonal antibodies. That goes fairly routinely. But on genetically engineered animals, their policy and their implementation have been really atrocious. So genetically engineered animals are regulated as though the DNA inserted into them to confer faster growth or less toxic excrement or whatever. That DNA is regulated as though it were a new animal drug, and that subjects the DNA and inevitably the animal itself to a very high level of often unnecessary level of scrutiny. And then you come to implementation, and you have a 22-year review, in effect, of that faster-growing salmon, even though the only expressed gene added to it was an extra growth hormone gene from the Chinook salmon. And so that the delay, leaving alone the bad policy, the delay is inexcusable. And then there was another atrocious set of decisions at FDA about the genetically engineered mosquitoes from Oxitec, a very, very ingenious genetic construction intended to reduce the mosquito population levels of Aedes aegypti, which carries chikungunya, dengue fever, Zika virus, a couple others. FDA took 5 years to approve a single field trial of this genetically engineered mosquito. Field trial, which, by the way, was never carried out, and a product that didn't belong at FDA, as in fact a colleague of mine and I pointed out in a Wall Street Journal op-ed in 2016. And the reason is interesting and revealing about the sometimes cluelessness of regulators. The way this genetically engineered mosquito worked is the construct introduced what's called a conditional lethal mutation, which means that although the mosquitoes grow fine in the lab or manufacturing facility, in the presence of a growth supplement, which happens to be tetracycline, when they're released into the wild, they survive only long enough to mate, pass this lethal mutation on to their progeny. The progeny die, the parents die, and the levels of the mosquito plummet. Well, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act says that animal drugs have to be safe and effective for the animal. And you can't rationalize how a lethal mutation is safe for the animal. And so we pointed that out in the op-ed, and ultimately, 6 months later, FDA ceded responsibility for the regulation of that mosquito and other similar products to EPA, where it belonged, EPA regulating pesticides. So, you know, this isn't rocket science. This is their own statute. They should have known what was in the statute. And compounding that poor policy, Scott Gottlieb, the outgoing, recently departed FDA commissioner, before he left, announced that FDA would probably be lumping the new gene editing techniques into what's considered genetic engineering of animals. Another bad decision, compounding an already unfortunate situation.
Now, just so people understand, that's had a really profound impact to the point that there actually aren't any genetically modified animals on the market, even though there's research saying that they have really useful uses or practical uses, and they're safe. So to get behind that, why do you think this technology is so controversial when it comes to plants and animals and the food supply. But then when it comes to biopharmaceuticals, like you're talking about, they seem to go through review a lot easier and they're less controversial more generally. Why is that, do you think?
Well, the reason that there's resistance or controversy, and I always refer to it as pseudo-controversy, is that there is a huge anti-biotechnology, anti-corporate cohort who, in effect, are shills for the organic industry, which is mortally threatened by the improvements that are wrought by genetic engineering. And they're also aided and abetted by the Russian propaganda machine, which, as an old colleague of mine used to say, wherever there's mischief to be stirred up that disadvantages America, look for the Russians. So that's part of the reason that there's such a high level of resistance and pseudo-controversy. But let me point out that, in fact, in addition to the Aqua Bounty, Aqua Advantage salmon, the faster-growing salmon, which should be on the market, available in the marketplace any time now in the U.S., there are very, very large numbers of laboratory animals that are genetically engineered that are on the market. In fact, the catalog is almost like a small telephone directory, and these are animals that are used, that have been engineered for appropriate toxicity testing, for models of human disease, for studying drug interactions, for studying the natural course of illnesses, and so on. And interestingly, because they're not food animals, FDA decided to invoke what's called regulatory, what's called enforcement discretion, which means that they're not going to require safety or efficacy testing for these. They just go on the market at will. Another product that they made that decision about is the glowfish, a fish that an aquarium fish that glows in the dark. And so FDA has a great deal of flexibility, but on genetically engineered food animals in particular, they decided they were going to build an empire. They were going to create new responsibilities for themselves, and it's almost destroyed an entire once promising sector of biotechnology.
So they definitely have a mixed record. I think most people in the field would agree with that. What's your take on their recent guidelines that were released just last month, I believe? And they're strictly voluntary, but they give some guidance to food companies that are selling quote unquote non-GMO products. And the guidelines from my understanding, they're pretty good in terms of what they're recommending, but they don't enforce anything. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's similar to the IRS saying you have to file your tax return, but you're really not obligated to pay anything. That's really voluntary, and you can imagine what the outcome of that would be. It's the unwillingness to enforce it that's at risk. And for those who aren't familiar with the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and what it says about food labeling is food labeling cannot be false or misleading in any particular. That's a quote. Cannot be false or misleading in any particular. And virtually all, almost all of the non-GMO verified, no genetic engineering claims are misleading because they imply a difference where one doesn't exist. And as you know, many of the non-GMO claims are for products for which there aren't any genetically engineered, at least recombinant DNA modified varieties, citrus, specialty crops like vegetables, fruits, and nuts are virtually non-existent through genetic engineering modern molecular genetic engineering techniques, except for papaya and bruise-resistant potatoes and a couple of others. But again, those claims are misleading and therefore violate the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. But for these many years, FDA has chosen not to take any enforcement actions.
I spoke to a couple of other experts for an article I wrote recently on this, and the impression I got from them is that this might be the FDA trying to tell these companies to right their ship without actually going after them legally. Do you think that's the case, or do you think maybe this is sort of them testing the waters to see how people are going to react to these policies that they're releasing?
Well, I don't think those two things are mutually inconsistent, Cameron. It could be either or both. But, considering the stringency of their enforcement actions elsewhere, I think it's an unwise and inadequate policy. To give you an example, in one of my articles recently, I referred to an FDA warning letter to a bakery in New England because the ingredient list included the word love. And FDA said, love is not a generally recognized food ingredient. And so you need to remove it or you'll be subject to blah, blah, blah injunctions and fines and so on. So, if FDA is warning about things like that, they should certainly take into consideration, take more seriously the information on labels that genuinely is misleading. And remember that these verification things, these seals of approval, are costly. And so the companies, Kellogg's, General Foods, and so on, are paying large amounts of money for that certification that then they have to pass along to consumers. So it's a ripoff as well as being misleading.
Well, we can't have baked goods made with love, Henry. That's just not acceptable these days.
Right. Except that by our mom.
So switching gears a little bit, I want to stick with labeling, but I want to get your take on the USDA bioengineered labels that are going into effect, I think, in 2020 or starting to go into effect anyway. I've heard mixed commentary from people. I've heard that these are terrible labels. They're inconsistent and confusing. And I've heard other people, both in the scientific community and in the food industry, say this is good. This is going to alleviate consumer fear about biotechnology. Where do you come down on that?
Well, this was a terribly unfortunate action by the Congress. It was well-intended in the sense that a few states, like Vermont, have actually introduced requirements for quote-unquote GMO labeling. And the food companies were concerned about an inconsistent national patchwork of requirements that differed state by state, which would have made it virtually impossible to design one kind of labeling for the entire country. And so they lobbied Congress to preempt the ability of states to do that. And if Congress had simply preempted state-by-state labeling, that would have been fine. That would have been a rational policy. Instead, they introduced a requirement for a federal requirement for bioengineered food and didn't define it well. They left that to USDA. And interestingly, and illustrating that there's no safety issue here involved, it didn't go to the USDA regulators to do this. It went to the Agricultural Marketing Service. And they created a colleague and I described in a Wall Street Journal article as possibly the worst regulation ever. I think that was the title of the piece. In fact, it's incomprehensible, It's something like 249 pages of gobbledygook, and it contains verbiage that's really extraordinary. It talks about, you know, in a regulation, you have to identify the costs and benefits. And so it talks about the costs being $3 billion up front, and then something like $80 to $200 million annually in perpetuity, as the rule says. And then the next sentence says, we do not anticipate any benefits to human health or the environment. So this is a rule whose benefit to cost ratio is zero, because there are no benefits and it's very costly, and it opens up companies to litigation, food companies to litigation, about whether or not they're conforming to the letter of the gobbledygook in the rule. So this is exactly the kind of rulemaking and legislation that Americans should resent. No benefit, costly, benefiting only the trial lawyers.
So that's incredible. So we're getting confusing labels that cost a lot of money that have no health or environmental benefit. Is that about where things stand?
That's about it. Yes.
Good Lord. Well, moving on to another topic that's related to this cost benefit question, what's your opinion on the controversy around glyphosate? I know there's some really major trials going on in the Bay Area where you have a handful of people accusing Monsanto and now Bayer of causing their cancer because of glyphosate exposure. So what's your take on that? What's going to happen, and why is this a problem, do you think?
Well, it's really a legal problem as much as anything, which I'm not qualified to answer. The science is pretty clear. As you know from the excellent infographic that appeared on the Genetic Literacy Project website, every national regulatory agency and the World Health Organization itself that have looked at the risk of this, of glyphosate, have found no evidence that it causes cancer. So it seems to me, again, as a non-lawyer, that the judges involved made errors in what they permitted to be introduced as evidence. The only outlier is the WHO's International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is known to be corrupt, which is known to be inept, and which in any case doesn't look at risk. They look at hazard, there being an important distinction. Hazard is the ability, of course, to cause a toxic effect. Risk takes into consideration exposure as well as the intrinsic harm that's possible. And so IARC, that International Agency for Research on Cancer, found probable carcinogenicity on the basis of hazard, but not risk, whereas everyone else worldwide who has looked at risk has found that it's unlikely to be a carcinogen. So we'll see whether these verdicts are overturned on appeal. It'll be very interesting to see. But glyphosate is the most widely used and safely used herbicide in the world.
And you have a recent article out, I think it was in Newsweek, with Stuart Smythe, where you guys were talking about the agricultural impacts if glyphosate is pulled off the market, which is happening in certain countries. I know Vietnam just did it, and Europe is contemplating it in the next few years. But what happens to farmers and consumers if agriculture no longer has access to this weed killer?
Well, the farmers are going to use other herbicides which are more toxic, more harmful to the environment, more toxic to farm workers, and which often don't work as well. So it'll be a real a real tragedy. In poorer countries, they'll probably have to resort to hand weaving, which is literally backbreaking, and which often falls to women and children. And so it'll compromise food security and human health. It'll be a disaster.
My goodness. Well, hopefully something stops these lawsuits or somebody steps in and just puts an end to it. But it could, because it seems you can convince a jury that something is dangerous, even if it's not. So I don't know what to say. Hopefully we can stop that.
Well, there are standards for what evidence can be introduced into trials. The so-called Daubert standard in federal lawsuits, for example. So again, we'll see whether appeals courts apply different standards from those of the trial judges up till now.
So this comes from another piece you wrote recently. I think you actually wrote it for Genetic Literacy Project, but you're talking about all of the academic research in medicine and some related fields that fails to replicate. And so we have policymakers possibly making decisions based on bad science. Do you think that plays into this issue we're talking about of potentially banning agricultural chemicals?
Well, you know, there's failure to replicate and failure to replicate. Some of it is misunderstanding of statistics or variation in experimental systems, different strains of animals, and so on. The kind of thing that I think is most worrisome and also offensive is what's sometimes called, it's research that's intended to get a flawed result. And my colleagues and I have written about that several times over the years. The Seralini experiment with rats, in which they were fed genetically engineered grain and or glyphosate, is an example. That was the so-called advocacy research, which was designed to get a flawed result. And that's an excellent example of it, because even though his paper was eventually retracted, it's still a cause celeb, and it's still referred to by the anti-biotechnology activists as an example of the harm of both glyphosate and genetically engineered material from plants. Non-replicability covers a lot of territory, and some of it is understandable. It's certainly undesirable, but it's the advocacy research that is really deplorable.
Yeah, absolutely. And just so people are clear, I think within the last year, there's been four different studies out of the European Union that conclusively debunked that initial study that Seralini and his team put out. So it's not just that his paper was retracted, it's that people tried to replicate his results. And they said, well, you did about 14 things wrong. So
yeah, good. And that makes another point, Cameron. It's that we're wasting research resources on debunking bad predatory research, which could be used to instead to seek the next big thing in animal or plant or human research.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, hopefully things start to turn around as the public gets more informed about this. But where can people learn more about you and your work? I know you're writing about this stuff constantly. Where do you want people to go?
My website that has my bio and links to my articles, henrymillermd.org, has links to a lot of my stuff.
All right, we'll send people there. And then you're on Twitter as well, right?
I am, yeah, at Henry I. Miller.
All right, well, check out Henry's website, follow him on Twitter, and thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to subscribe if you like the podcast. We're on iTunes and Spotify now. You can also check us out at geneticliteracyproject.org. We'll see you next time.